Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your Ka'Chava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're trying to connect two things that seem really far apart: the day-to-day chaos of high-stakes politics and the slow, grinding decay of the American dream.
Yeah, we're really looking at two kinds of risk. On one hand, you have the very immediate, granular stuff, you know, power plays, political maneuvering.
The headlines.
Exactly. And on the other hand, we have this really fascinating academic piece that uses financial options theory to analyze, well, something you wouldn't think you could measure. Hope. Or socioeconomic mobility.
And that's our mission for this deep dive. We want to see what happens when the political system feels like it's starting to crack right at the moment when economic opportunity has, for a lot of people, already vanished.
Right. We use 2 core ideas. First, we'll look at some of these political dramas as signs of a bigger trend. And second, we're going to treat hope itself as a measurable asset.
An asset that has been, according to the source, dangerously mispriced.
And if we can sort of quantify that, we can maybe get at why everything feels so brittle right now. You know, it's about moving beyond just the gut reaction.
Okay, so let's start with the political calculus then. The immediate crisis, the whole drama around the release of the Epstein files.
Yeah, that was something else.
You had Donald Trump on Sunday night making this huge public statement, pushing House Republicans to vote for the release. And his line was, quote, "We have nothing to hide."
I mean, it was a very clear attempt to get out in front of the story, to rewrite the narrative.
But that narrative held up for, what, maybe a day? Because when he was asked if he actually signed the bill,
the answer was a complete 180. He says, "Sure I would. It is really a Democrat problem. And it is a hoax. The whole thing is a hoax."
Which is just such a massive contradiction. I mean, if it's a hoax and a Democrat problem, why fight for months in a very disciplined way to keep those files private?
Exactly. And the source material we're looking at lays out 6 different theories to explain it. And the fascinating part is that, well, none of them really hold up under scrutiny.
Not perfectly, anyway.
Right. Like, take the Nixonian ploy theory, the idea that he's just faking transparency to look innocent.
Okay.
Well, the analysis points out that Nixon tried to hire someone to look for evidence, hoping they wouldn't find anything. This is like Nixon deciding to just release the Oval Office tapes himself.
It's not a cover-up. It's releasing the actual evidence, which is way, way riskier.
And even the most plausible idea, that maybe the files were scrubbed, you know, sanitized by his people, that has huge problems too.
First, why the long, desperate fight if they were already clean? All you did was make yourself look incredibly guilty for months.
That's problem number 1. And number 2 is this huge assumption that the Department of Justice has the only copies. What if another entity, like, say, the Epstein estate, has the originals?
Oh, wow.
If you release a scrubbed version, then you've just handed everyone absolute proof of a cover-up. It almost doesn't matter what's in them at that point.
So the whole thing just smells of a forced move, like the slow drip of information was becoming so corrosive they had to do something drastic.
And that's what brings us to the bigger picture. You know, the whole can't see the forest for the trees problem. It's hard to spot a long-term trend when you're living in the day-to-day chaos.
Right.
But the analysis we're citing, it actually pegs this Epstein vote, where dozens of Republicans in the House defied him, as the biggest sign of weakness we've seen in this Trump 2.0 era.
So his grip is slipping. And it's not just a one-off thing, right? The source lists a bunch of examples.
A whole pattern. You've got the fake electors in places like Nevada and Georgia actually facing legal consequences now. That's new. His political machine usually shields people better than that.
And then there's the legislative stuff.
Yeah, the failure to force that redistricting in Indiana, the fights over tariffs with the Supreme Court, and even just basic administrative competence. He lost a second FEMA administrator in 6 months. That suggests things are unstable internally.
So the bottom line, according to this analysis, is that GOP members are learning they can defy him and survive politically. It's becoming normalized.
It is. It points to a real loss of authority. But, and this is a big but, the source always adds the caveat. He's, quote, orange-colored and endowed with 9 lives.
We've seen it before.
We have. He's come back from things that would have ended any other political career. The grab him by the poo tape, January 6th.
Uh-huh.
So while the trend lines point down, you'd be a fool to predict the end.
Okay. So if that's the short-term political noise, that uncertainty, let's pivot to the long-term trend line. This is where we get into the economics of hope.
Right. We're shifting from the daily chaos to what the analysis calls a kind of slow-moving structural certainty, a certainty of failure for most people, ironically.
And this is where the source gets really deep, right? It brings in the myth of Pandora.
It does. Pandora opens the jar, all the curses fly out, but one spirit gets trapped inside, Elpis, which in Greek means both hope and foreknowledge. The American idea was always built on uncertain hope.
The idea that your effort, not your birth, decided your fate.
And the argument is that this option, this chance at upward mobility, has just decayed. It's lost its value.
And the analysis starts in a pretty surprising place by pointing out this massive $80 trillion asset that inequality researchers just ignore.
They completely ignore it. Social Security and Medicare.
Why?
Because it's non-marketable. You can't sell your future Social Security benefits. But those FICA payments you make, they're not just a tax. They're, in effect, inflation-protected annuities.
Yeah.
They're the bedrock of stability for working people.
So by leaving this $80 trillion collective balance sheet out of the picture, economists are basically missing the entire security part of the American social contract.
Precisely. The source gives a great example. A 45-year-old worker might have, say, $25,000 in net worth on paper.
Okay.
But the present value of their future Social Security and Medicare benefits, it's about $1 million in implicit wealth. It's just an incredible figure to leave out of the conversation.
And this structure, it's very American. The source contrasts it with Europe.
Right. Europe built a higher floor, a pure pay-as-you-go safety net. America built a lower floor, but, and this is the critical part, combined it with institutional support for taking risks, things like bankruptcy protection, limited liability. That combination was the engine.
The engine for mobility.
It was. And even though the Supreme Court said back in 1960 that you don't have a legal property right to your Social Security, the whole accounting fiction of it being earned creates this powerful political shield. It feels like yours. And that feeling underpins hope.
Which brings us to the core metaphor of the piece, hope as a financial option. As a citizen, you hold the right, but not the obligation, to move up.
It's like having a coupon for success with a fixed price. The option is the coupon, and the strike price is what it costs in time, money, education, to even try to move up.
And back in the mid-century, that option was incredibly valuable. If you were born in the bottom quintile, Q1, you had about a 12% chance of making it all the way to the top, to Q5.
And crucially, those middle rungs, Q2 to Q4, they were desirable destinations in themselves. They represented real, achievable success.
But today, that option has decayed.
Massively. That Q1 to Q5 jump is now down to about 7%. The middle rungs have lost their luster. And maybe most importantly, the strike price, the cost to even try, has just exploded.
So let's break that down. The source details 5 components of this decay, measured not in dollars, but in hours of work. Let's start with hope itself, the upside convexity.
Okay, so almost all of the real gains in the last few decades have gone to the very top, to Q5. So for someone at the bottom, the highest expected value path isn't a slow, methodical climb anymore.
It's a long shot.
It's the tail leap, the YOLO. Why work for 30 years for a minimal reward when you could gamble on a moonshot?
Okay, number two is security, the downside protection. If hope is the upside call option, security is the downside put.
Right, it's your insurance. And the cost of falling has become catastrophic for the bottom and middle. Meanwhile, the wealthy have a much, much thicker crash mat. Their downside is way more protected.
And that gap amplifies risk aversion for everyone else.
Of course. If failing means you're buried under a mountain of non-dischargeable student debt, you just stop taking productive risks.
Which leads right into the third part, the strike price, the cost to play the game.
We talk a lot about tuition. But the source says the effective strike price for just getting into the middle class is up by about 60%. That's tuition, plus living costs, plus the wages you don't earn while you're in school.
So even if the odds of success were the same, which they aren't, the entry fee is so much higher that the option becomes worthless for a lot of people.
Exactly. And the fourth component makes it even worse, the mobility tax.
Which is just about geography.
It's simple and it's brutal. Where is opportunity concentrated? High productivity cities, your New Yorks, your San Franciscos. But those same cities have priced out entry for the middle class, housing, childcare.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
So to get ahead, you have to move to a place you can't afford to live. It's a catch-22.
It is. It just compounds the financial strike price.
And all this together, when you look at the aggregate value of this option of American citizenship, the picture is pretty stark.
In 1970, the data shows a ladder society. The peak value of that option was in the middle, in Q2 and Q3. Every rung up gave you a proportional reward.
And today?
By 2023, it's a birth equity society. The value is almost entirely concentrated at the top, in Q5. For Q1, hope is now tied only to lottery ticket outcomes. The whole two-generation option, the idea that if I can't make it, my kids will, has lost more than half its economic value since 1970.
And this is where it all circles back to the political chaos and extremism we started with. When that real-world path to success disappears, people look for a substitute. They look for synthetic convexity.
That's the core insight of the piece. When hope is confiscated, speculation becomes rebellion. People start looking for shortcuts, for high-leverage gambles. The source literally connects high lottery ticket sales to counties with low economic mobility.
So things like the mania for crypto, meme stocks, even the extreme polarization of politics. It's a kind of proxy revolt.
It is. If you can't get economic leverage, you seek out moral leverage, or speculative leverage. Nihilism, the source says, is just the efficient market of despair. If playing by the rules has an expected value of zero, gambling on an extreme outcome is the rational choice.
So how do you fix it? How do you reprice hope?
Well, the policy ideas all fall into three buckets: lowering strikes, widening tails, and protecting the floor.
Okay, so lowering strikes would be things like
making public higher education tuition-free for the bottom half of earners. You're literally just reducing the entry fee to the middle class.
And widening tails. That sounds like it's about reforming failure.
Exactly. Reforming bankruptcy law to allow for a faster restart. Like a Chapter 11 for individuals, not just for corporations. So that trying and failing isn't a life sentence of debt.
And protecting the floor.
That's things like portable benefits that follow workers from job to job. But the most interesting idea is creating a new metric. A mobility index.
I love that idea, actually monetizing the data on mobility.
And then you tie federal infrastructure funding to a city's score on that index. You make upward mobility as visible and as politically important as the unemployment rate.
You make the invisible asset of hope visible again.
That's the goal.
This has been quite a deep dive. We've connected the immediate signs of political weakness, the Epstein mess, the loss of party control, with this deep quantified collapse of socioeconomic hope.
And that critical link, to go back to Pandora and Elpis, is the trade-off between hope, which is uncertainty, and foreknowledge, which is certainty. Mid-century America, the argument goes, institutionalized a kind of controlled volatility. There was real uncertainty about who would succeed, and that made striving rational.
But now we know too much. We have algorithms that predict everything: our credit scores, our life expectancy, our chances of success. We traded that jar of hopeful uncertainty for a box of deterministic forecasts.
In our search for safety, we kind of accidentally locked hope away again. The takeaway from the source, though, is that we can translate these big moral questions into measurable financial ones. we can actually see how different policies would change the price of that American option.
So, to leave you with a provocative thought to chew on, if political chaos really is a symptom of mispriced hope, which policy from that list of fixes, whether it's tuition-free college or bankruptcy reform or that mobility index, which one would you bet on to really reopen Pandora's jar? What would it take to make that strike price feel like it's within reach again? We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Stephen at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Stephen.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.